Thank you. You're on the record.
Okay. Hi, this is Jen Miller for the record, and Tony Izzo and I are the co-chairs for the Rail Belt Subcommittee. And to get us kicked off, we have a off-the-cuff proposed agenda. And so we'll just I'll verbalize that and just seek, you know, we had a really good session last week, and it was great hearing back from the subcommittee members on how to alter the agenda, the discussion, to make it more productive. So I just encourage everyone to do that this go around. But as far as an agenda, we'd like to start with just a quick, you know, recap on action timing and, you know, just what we're heading towards as deliverables. And then Mark has a template to share where he's taken the actions that we consolidated during our last meeting and put that into the template, so he'll share that. And then one of the key brainstorm topics we had is around how do we incentivize generation diversification. And it's somewhat, what we wanted to say is instead of having a stick, is there a carrot approach? And so really I put together a slide with some ideas that I came up with yesterday. So I really want to open that up to a brainstorm session. And then Erin has volunteered to take the lead on that one pager, because we talked about her working the generation one pager. And her and I can work on that together. The other thing that we didn't get to last time, I want to just test with the group, is we didn't have a discussion around the demand side and if we have any goals or actions in that space. And so defer to the group if that's an important topic for us that we want to touch on or save it for another time. And then the other thing we wanted to do is just to look at our short, mid, and long-term goals and see if there's any, you know, we had our action list that was brought forward, but we wanted to make sure, you know, in the last session we were really going through and kind of addressing those draft actions, but we wanted to take a minute to step back in each of our short, mid, and long-term categories and say, are there any recommendations that we would come up with for those? And so that's what I have, those kind of four, kind of a tactical, what's our timing path forward on actions, brainstorm on diversification incentives, talk about demand side, and then revisiting our short, mid, and long-term goals. So that's my proposed agenda, but super flexible. Tony and team, any comments?
Move to approve.
Good job, Zach. All right. All right. So where we left off, all right, we got a thumbs up from Carl. Where we left off last time is we, you know, consolidated our list of recommendations, and each except for Aaron and I, everyone else took one pager to write, which was fantastic. And anyways, the goal is to have those drafts sent out to the subcommittee by this Friday. And if you don't have everyone's email address, you can always send it to Tony and I, and then we'll redistribute. But the goal is to review those over the weekend and then use Monday afternoon's working session to talk through comments on it. We'll just basically kind of go one by one and talk through comments and feedback. But the goal is to get them out by Friday, share them with the group, so we can be ready to discuss Monday afternoon.
So, John Sims, I did have some administrative challenges logging into that link that you sent, which had everything. So I don't know if I could, if an example could be emailed to me directly, that would be helpful for me. Yeah.
To build off that, I was able to get in, but it was, I mean, challenge is probably a good underestimation of what it was like, and I don't know if it's because it was on an iPad or what system, but I was not able to edit the document online, that the outline, for me it was transmission and storage. I was going to have to recreate those in Word, and if there's some way to just get those templates in, you know, Word documents sent to me, it would be great.
And Mark, while you're pulling that up, it sounds like maybe instead of a link to a folder, if we could just like send the draft Word documents, everyone has them right in their email, makes it easy. Cool.
This is Erin. What is our protocol for
suggesting edits and changes to these documents if we're sending them out as Word docs.
That's fair. So, Aaron, you're thinking, like, if we had an online version where we could track comments, I guess I didn't know if we would actually have time to do detailed edits to for the comment period, or if we would just discuss them during Monday's session, because they're going to come out on Friday, and maybe as we get to each one, people just verbally provide their comments. I don't know. What is the good thing?
I can absolutely see that, and there might be, maybe after we discuss it Monday, there may be some comments. So I'm wondering if there's SharePoint or... I realize I'm getting into the weeds, but I'm just thinking, like, how does this all work?
Yeah, I guess I had envisioned similar to how we did last week, where we would kind of draft on the board and be able to see it up there, so we could all make those modifications. That's always worked well for us. As long as we're going to meet face-to-face,
yeah.
If we're not, we will need to have some other option for tracking those changes.
And Tony, for the record, I agree. I think the initial matter that I'd like to overcome is just for cybersecurity issues, our protocols just aren't going to allow me to open Word online, for example. That's just not going to happen. And so I've got to have some way to get at least drafted, either number one, and then number two, another way that everybody can, upload, edit, mark it up. I think version control would be the terminology I'd use.
Yep. So I guess we'll have to work on finding a good solution to...
We have SharePoint.
Right.
So we have
and I think that's what I'm hearing, though, is that folks are struggling from that platform. Anyway, I will. I'll start with
And Mark, just to maybe close it out. So maybe our base plan is draft one pagers get sent out to the group on Friday. On Monday, we will work through one at a time. We don't want to get too bogged down in wordsmithing live with everybody, but I like what John said. Let's just have everybody there capture comments live. And then maybe Monday we can figure out if we want to do additional editing after that. We can figure out a protocol for version control.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to start out with just review the slide that we showed in the... Sorry, go ahead, Aaron.
Before the tactical part, so then am I understanding correctly, those papers will be what will be presented at the Tuesday, October 3rd meeting, or will there be further work that's needed? I'm just trying to make sure I see this all through.
I think those one pages are heading towards the final product,
okay.
And I think maybe let's see how far we get on Tuesday, or sorry,
okay.
Monday,
okay.
And see how we're shaping up.
Okay, I'm just wondering if there are other products we need to be thinking about preparing. So maybe you're going to get to that.
Okay. So, just again to review, this is a example of what the report will look like with the priority and then a strategy from each of the subcommittees. And so, for instance, transmission is one of your strategies, right? So that would be the strategy for the rail belt transmission, and then underneath that are the various actions we've identified that support transmission. All right. So from the from a document perspective, then this is what I created for this, actually for all of the subcommittees are the strategy documents that list the strategy. This is what will need to be, fleshed out by someone, is, what's the purpose of this, the background, and then underneath this are the various strategies that you've identified. And you have this, also you have this sheet that we printed out for you that also shows these action items. So we have one for transmission, we have one for generation, we have one for storage, and so again, and then where you can find these, sharing again, on the SharePoint site, I've loaded them on the SharePoint site.
And Mark, these are the Word documents, so that you're also just going to email us for ease of access.
So on the SharePoint site, under the Rail Transmission Generation Storage Subcommittee, you have a draft executive summary folder. These Word documents, you know, list all of your strategies with the action items under them, and then you also have a folder that has the draft action items documents that I sent out last week after our meeting. All of this is accessible on the SharePoint site, but as we talked about, I will also put these in a folder and send them out to the task force members in an email so you have access directly to them. My request would be to go ahead and, once you've completed that, send it back to me, and then I will load it into the SharePoint. We're happy to do that. Now, the only other little administrative piece would be to ask if someone on the subcommittee would be willing to take on the strategy level documents as well to flesh out the purpose, background, and maybe the expected results. Because in my estimation, that is what is going to fill out the fork way, right? And so my point is that you guys are well down the road to getting our report complete. We just have these high-level strategy documents to flesh out. And maybe we do that next Monday, right? You know, because I think they'll be informed by what you put into the individual action sheets.
And Mark, I think Monday we'll be spending a lot of time going through the action sheet, and then really it seems like the summary by strategy area is a composite of just pulling those related actions. And maybe we can take a look at it, but I don't know if that's something Michael Baker could, you know, once we've populated the actions, the information might be there where it can be rolled up into the executive summary.
Sure.
So maybe we make that call on Monday once we've seen the action sheets.
Okay. So that's my piece, and now I will get the PowerPoint.
Oh, thanks.
That's for you.
Okay, so one of my actions was we talked a lot about wanting to see if there were any carrots that we could offer instead of sticks to promote generation diversification, and so this was my rough brainstorm yesterday. But really this is meant to be an open brainstorm, any ideas, and if Mark, if we have new ideas, if you can capture them, and if we need to create another slide. But I think, you know, an RPS or a clean energy standard does drive towards diversification, and I think what the concern was, if there's penalties, those penalties get, because we're a co-op setup, those penalties get passed on to the ratepayer and actually increase rates. And so we wanted to see if there's other ideas, instead of a penalty, are there incentives that could drive us towards diversification to make sure we do it. And that was my context.
This is Chris. With the RPS, there is penalties, but there isn't necessarily penalties with the clean energy standard.
Okay, thank you.
So one has more of a carrot than a stick.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Tony Izzo for the record. Kurt, I agree. We had Jenny Somner, actually Aaron, hosted or facilitated, but Jenny Somner, who's group manager of modeling and analysis, one of the symposiums, RPS and CES, National Policy Comparisons, and I actually pulled off the recording and have the, you know, times written down, but it's just pretty clear that penalties apply to IOUs, and if you were to introduce a penalty, I mean, first you have to back up and say, why would you need a policy to do something unless it was uneconomic? And I have to look at the circumstances, and I have every reason to believe, and I think in the coming months, you're going to see clear signals that they'll get probably filed at the Regulatory Commission. That's how public and obvious they will be, that economics are shifting, you know, away from natural gas. So I subscribe to that principle. I mean, if you want to drive me to do something uneconomic, you need a policy to do it. Secondly, there is only one way to recover penalties as a co-op, and that's to go through the ratepayer. And I want this thing to succeed. You know, we've set a goal of 60% carbon, well, 50% clean energy by 2050. I think my board would gladly move that up if they, you know, if they, and I think they will move it up if they start to see that that's attainable, because we're worried about keeping the lights on in 4.5 years. Anyway, I just wanted to point out, I thought that was fascinating. There are states that have both, you know, RPS and a clean energy standard. That was interesting. And I truly believe from the circles that I, you know, the interactions I have and, based on the job, I mean, that, currently what you're gonna see is a whole lot of lobbying against what's there. And I would much rather, see something that we can recommend and get behind and support.
Maybe just to open up the diversification incentive idea, do you guys mind if I just rattle off a few ideas just to get it kicked off? Or Aaron, if you have a comment first?
Yeah, if I could just say generally, I love the idea. First of all, thanks for preparing these ideas. I love the idea of coming up with positive incentives and high in the sky things. And I hear what Tony is saying that, you know, if it makes economic sense, the utilities are going to do it. But I'd love to especially hear from Tony and folks who are deep into the utility world, like, what would be an amazing kickback, like, you know, debt forgiveness or, you know, accelerated depreciation? I mean, what would some of these sort of blue sky ideas be that maybe the state could even help with? I mean, just thinking parallel to, you know, how I try to guide and discipline my own kids, like positive reinforcements work, right? So they make kids excited. And if I think about, you know, really awesome incentives for them, it gets them excited. So I would love to have a sort of an unbounded brainstorming session there. So thank you.
Yeah, and in response, I also mentioned Carl Hamlin up, but I agree, and I would like to have that discussion. I think you know, currently as things are, you know, being proposed, it's very difficult to work with parties that, you know, to support their position, vilify, you know, those that might act, those that have a fiduciary responsibility for something that's very black and white, like lights on or not. Jen, you and RIPP, frankly, are the, you know, you set the bar high because that's not how you approach things at all. It's like, how do we solve problems together? Where the current legislation is, you know, there are a lot of anecdotes and platitudes about, you know, why the utilities won't do something. And I think if we were able to trade places for, you know, a week, you know, there'd be some epiphanies. But anyway, I like that idea of a discussion like that. I've heard lots of input from legislators about wanting to do things like that. And I think it's our opportunity to mess up if we don't. You know, if we don't present some examples by which we can achieve success.
And I'll just respond to Tony's comment and then hand it over to Carl, but I think this discussion, let's not get bogged down in what's been proposed, whether it's a clean energy standard or RPS. Maybe let's couch that and tie this more to our long-term goal of significant diversification. And what we said is, well, how do we make sure we get there? And are there incentives we want to put in place to get to that long-term objective? So maybe we, you know, dissect those two discussion points just so that we're unbounded on what's possible. And I'll hand it over to Carl.
But yeah, I'll just support your comment of just brainstorm some ideas without trying to put them in policy buckets, and following on Tony's, you know, suggestion of how to positively incentivize. So I'm just all ears. I don't, so go ahead. Jen, throw out some ideas if you have some.
Okay. So, and this is, some of this is based on my experience as an ICP and, you know, what are our hurdles for doing generation projects. But the first one was around, you know, do you say, okay, let's set some diversification targets, and if met, the state kicks back money to either fund transmission storage, like in that midterm goal bucket, we talked about the need for infrastructure on transmission storage, or maybe there's a loan forgiveness that further reduces the electricity rates, and so it's kind of a way to keep ratcheting down our energy price. So that was one idea. I'm going to skip that second one that was added. And then I've talked about, the Renewable Energy Fund. I'm actually looking at that. So when you're trying to create a new generation project, there's a lot of development work, preliminary engineering studies, interconnection integration studies, geotech, you know, I mean, and those are expensive costs. And so for a new company to take on $200,000-$300,000 of development spend to figure out if they have a project or not, is a big risk, and it is something that a lot of companies will just say, I don't have the appetite for that. And so we want more companies coming in, looking at generation ideas, you know, something similar to the Renewable Energy Fund that could be used for, and it could be, I think matching is right, because I think you need to have skin in the game to make the right decisions. And not waste money. And so some kind of fund, though, that's aimed at, hey, if you've got a project idea that'll diversify our generation, you know, you can apply for a matching fund or something like that to just get more ideas in the hopper and more projects on their feet. And then similar, we've been lucky, we've been awarded the Power Project Fund. So if you want to lower the cost of energy, low interest debt is the way to go. And the Power Project Fund, it's you can spread that debt out for the project life. And so the more you can, you know, a typical business, a commercial loan would be, you know, what, 8 to 15 years at the most. But for our two projects, we've done a 25 and 30-year loan.
We like it called patient capital.
Very patient. Very, and we appreciate the patience. But it's reflected in our rates, right? And so, but the Power Project Fund has a limit, you know, it has limited funding, and so looking at expanding that funding for new generation projects that need the diversification, it's been an amazing program, and without it, we wouldn't have done Willow, to be honest, and that's what got us started. We couldn't find a good debt source. And then another thing is the interconnection cost is a significant cost for new projects, and it's not eligible under the investment tax credit. And so that's a cost that you don't get a discount on. And anyway, so maybe there could be a fund to help with that. And so, I mean, this is a wish list, right? So I'm not. And then the last one is, you know, I don't think everyone understands how much work the utilities have to put into, if you want to do a new capital project, that's a lot of staff time. Because not only are you trying to run base generation and operations, but now you're like, oh, we want this new idea and this, and you have to evaluate those to make sure you're not going to take the grid down. And so some sort of funding to support utilities having more staff to look at new projects, and I'm you know, overstepping here, it's not my business, but I just know that when we go to utilities, they've been super supportive, but if there were 10 of us, that you could easily overwhelm a company. Anyways, and so that was my brainstorm. Thanks.
John Sims, just real quick, one, that, you know, the piece on the debt, especially in these markets, as the debt market continues to get more and more challenging, I think that's going to be a critical piece going forward. There are a lot of projects today that are no longer economical simply because of that piece, even if it was looking good without any sort of assistance there. So that's a critical point. But the general statement I want to make is you know, anything we can do from a, you know, regulation perspective, or from a statute perspective to make it easier. So for some reason, recently there's been a negative connotation to hitting the easy button, but when you hit the easy button, that's because you haven't had to do as much work, right? And that means it's cheaper. So the more work you have to do, the harder it is, the more expensive it is. So anything we can do for these projects specifically related to diversification to make it easier for those projects to move forward from a regulations perspective, from a, you know, Commissioner Kerber had a great point about understanding what's coming down the pipe. I think anything that allows them to reference statute is going to be a lot easier for these things, because then we have a sense of surety as a utility going in that we know there's going to be support for this, or at least foundational piece of language that they can look to.
I've got a few that I wrote down while listening, but one that comes to mind right away, based on John's comments, is the even with PURPA, for renewable projects that are coming online, we're required today under SB 123 to go, get project pre-approval. And you have the RRC that's likely not going to have an IRP out for, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years. So today, I might have information based on NDAs that I've signed that indicate that, a renewable power with the necessary storage to firm it up, maybe that's going to come in at 10 cents. If I were to go take that to the commission today, technically it would not be approved without me, without waiting until you saw, that cargo of LNG came in. It was, it equated to X. So we're caught in this unintentional gray area of that could last about 5 years. We don't have 5 years to play with. So that's that would be one that I wanted to bring up to statutes and regulations this afternoon. Another one that comes to mind is, in the context of Jen's example here, that I'm working on the transmission, the transmission action item. And to me, it's, I think about highways, bridges, transmission, you can include pipelines, are built for the public good. We have this, and you've all heard me too many times talk about how, weak the system is overall. If we're going to get federal dollars coming in, we're going to need state match. No utility is going to own that transmission. It's going to end up being under the umbrella, likely, of AEA, I hope, along with the Northern Intertie, maybe the section of transmission that's part of Bradley Lake. I would buy for Bradley Lake, from a transmission authority. I think that's an opportunity for the state to, and I've heard legislators talk about issuing geo bonds, that if they wanted to invest in something that was going to open up economic development opportunities and facilitate the diversification of fuel supply. You created a redundant grid from, one end of the rail belt to the other. I think you have an opportunity with that, then, if you want to go towards the debt forgiveness. Today, I'm roughly 20 cents a kilowatt hour MEA. If you pay off all my debt, I might drop down to 18 cents or 17.5 cents. Now, there are other utilities that they could drop their rates in half, but it's disparate, and I don't know that it really solves the overall problem. If you pay for everybody's fuel and you drop power, you dropped every across the rail belt, you might get to 12 to 15 cents. I'd be at 12. I think you guys would be at that or lower. You're talking about $450 million a year you have to subsidize. Well, what can you buy with that, right? If you offset that. If you want to pay down debt, I think rolling up transmission, this is what my recommendation would be, into some form of authority, you could certainly at that point combine it with a state economic development goal to bring in, increase the denominator, more kilowatt hour sales, but you could pay down the debt on that and eliminate wheeling altogether, other than the annual O&M on that transmission. Now you've got like a DOT highway. you know, people will pay the operation and maintenance to use it. And then I would combine with that an incentive for transmission interconnects for diversified generation. You know, those are the opportunities to fund things that to me would be a real sustainable, significant first step towards some kind of a, some call it unification, but I think maximize the efficiency of, as if you had, you know, one utility, which again would be very difficult to unwind as we talked about last week. And I see Carl's hand is up, so I'll just pause there at one other.
Yeah, Tony and John both, I guess, my hand was going up as you were speaking, but then some of it got answered, you know, as you're speaking. I was looking for, you know, specific ideas, and then you both got into those. And so, thank you for that. I hear you on the potential statute and regulations that could help in terms of the RGE evaluation of projects in a future or a projected cost context instead of a historic or actual context. And I was going to ask Jen then about, you know, from her kind of wish list of the different types of funds, do you think it's necessary to have both a power project fund and a fund similar to the REF, or, I mean, maybe we just focus on one fund approach for new generation or diversification, and if so, which has the greatest lever on your project, do you think?
This is Curtis. Actually, there are two very distinct programs. The Renewable Energy Fund is targeted for renewable type of energy, and it's a grant program. And it goes through an evaluation process, and then it is then reviewed by the Renewable Energy Fund Advisory, and which consists of four legislative members, and then it goes for specific funding. The Power Project Fund is a loan program that is patient capital that's usually set at a 52-month trailing average and is capitalized by selling the loans or by new funding from the legislature, but that is completely generating new income for specific projects. And ironically, the Power Projects Fund in the IIJ world, the infrastructure world, can be used to help provide communities with the federal match. So they're very distinct programs, one being a grant, one being a loan program. And there's a loan committee that goes with the Renewable Energy Committee, I mean with the Power Project Fund, and then depending on the level of the loan, it goes to the Board of Directors, and then based on that, then it could go to the legislature for funding. At the REF level, the legislature funds the project at a designated amount at the beginning of the process, where depending on the size of the loan, they do it during the process. So they're very distinct programs, and both very successful programs.
Carl, I was just going to add on, just from my view, I like, so the when it comes to grant funding, I think those are smaller awards, you know, in the early development phase where maybe you can give a lot of bang for your buck where you're giving somebody $100,000 to kind of share that risk of developing a project when you don't know if you have one or not. And so that might get us more ideas, but those are small dollar amounts. And then for the loan program, those are large capital dollars within the state's getting a return on that money. And so in my mind, grants should be small, loans could be large. Just, you know, as far as when you're, I always like people having skin in the game because it drives good things.
Yeah, and we might get more traction in the loan avenue because we can't expect to have, I don't know, legislative pre-authorization of each diversification project that we want on the rail belt, or we'll never get anything off the ground, you know, in the short term. And so that's why I'm kind of asking in terms of prioritization.
So one concern that I that I have actually, Mark, you know, in the discussion that we had with the surveys this morning, you know, I think everybody on this committee and on the task force is kind of want affordability as a major component of that. But then when I hear Tony talk about debt relief, I think about the missed opportunity cost for reliability, right? It would be such a shame, in my opinion, if we came out with a recommendation where we pay off everyone's debt that reduces the cost, but then because we don't have reliability, we're forced right back into the same situation where we are before, only with an ongoing debt obligation of the state to pay for these things. So I'm really nervous about that affordability prioritization, because I think it's definitely important and critical. But over the long term, we have to be thinking about, you know, because I view this as a sustainable goal of affordability, not a moment in time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's critical, because we can do a lot of things in this moment to reduce the cost of power, but we should be thinking long term. And if we're still funding things as as a regulated utility, the cost is just going to bounce right back up. So hopefully we take advantage of the opportunity. If the state is going to make contributions or make an effort for funding certain activities, it should be towards reliability, because that is the most expensive piece of utility operations along the rail belt, is that reliability piece.
Mm-hmm. Erin, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I appreciate that comment, Dawn. And I don't know if accelerating depreciation would fit into any of these categories. I'm not enough of an accounting wizard to know, but is that something that would be useful, accelerating depreciation of existing assets? I feel like I hear that all the time as a barrier. But does that also get into your concern?
Well, so you're possibly opening up a can of worms there on how you would draft that. You know, so from my perspective, accelerating depreciation is fantastic, because I earn on that sooner,
mm-hmm.
which ultimately makes it more expensive. So the awful answer is it depends on how that's drafted and the devil in the details there, but that's something we need to be very cautious about as it relates to the whole and not just the individual entity. Does that make sense? So it's possible that it could help things, but for a private entity, that wouldn't help with reducing the cost. You'd actually just make it more expensive, because you're bringing all those costs up as opposed to spreading them out over a longer time frame.
Would that be the same for a cooperative utility then? Is there any case in which you think it works?
I think I approach it from a different angle. I certainly agree, but rather than add on, I would say one of the challenges in a regulated utility business is that you can't recover, you're not allowed to recover on investments through rates until it's in service. And so I'm a huge fan. I really think that independent, you know, power producers are going to likely be the catalyst or what facilitates the diversification. But if NEA has to build something, we go borrow, or we, you know, maybe we can qualify for grants now under some of these new programs. Historically, we didn't. We were too large. But if we went and borrowed $100 million, it's the carrying cost of that alone for the period of years that it takes to, you know, buy, deliver materials, to, you know, start constructing. All of that's just going out the door, and you're not able to recover it through rates until it's actually in use. And when I was in Lower 48, we called those accounting orders. I had not heard that term up here much, but you would go into a commission and you would have to get explicit permission for a specific thing, you know, to allow you to, you know, eliminate that huge risk. I think there's different ways to skin the cat, Erin. I just don't know. I don't think that accelerating depreciation could help. I just don't see a way for the state. If I were a legislator, as I think of myself, maybe following this process, and there's a recommendation that we all get behind. I can't help but, you know, from being in the business of wanting to present it in a value proposition. If you're going to just pay off my debt, it's going to help me this year. That's really not a narrative I'm comfortable with. But I might go on with something 10 times bigger, but it's a proposition. There's a way to measure it and see results, and I'm going to build something that's sustainable over some period of time. Then, you know, then the dollar amount doesn't worry me so much. I'm not asking for a gift anymore. There's a trade-off. I think Bradley Lake's a great example of that. The Northern Intertie is a great example of that.
And Tony and John, what I'm hearing you say is if we're going to do some kind of reward structure or incentive, it needs to be structural, not a one-time small reduction in rates. It's something, like you said, Tony, where if it was to go towards a unified transmission system, then everybody's benefiting from that, and it's a structural change that is a long-term project rather than a one-time decrease. And I did want to revisit, Tony, you brought up about giving the RCA a mechanism to evaluate projects, not just from today's price, but a forecast. And so one idea is, would the RCA ever have a published Rail Belt forecast that they are comparing projects against, instead of having each utility have to say kind of what their forecast is? Or, and I don't know enough in this space, but I looked to John and Tony about this.
That seems, you know, it's an evolving, almost day to day, week to week, changing dynamic as we, you know, on one front we negotiate together with, you know, potential extension of some supply or trying to address the capital cost needed for somebody to bring known gas online that might extend things for a couple of years, or the near-term things like Homer Electric needing 4 billion cubic feet next April 1. And it's all of those things represent significant challenges, you know, where we're not required to, nor could we, disclose that information without it harming the opportunity in some way. It's not eliminating it. So, big fan of transparency. Wish there could be more. I think that what we need from, I think John explained the other day very well, it was the Cooking Up Recovery Act that told the commission to do more than just evaluate the gas supply contract on price. It was more than that. It was, they had to look, I think, at the alternative.
Right.
And, you know, what's the alternative if you don't do this? And that changed in statute, and all of a sudden gas contracts started to get approved again.
And I think, you know, what we discussed at our last meeting, which was the concept of almost adding to that language where not only do they have to think about the ramifications of not approving a gas supply contract from a power generation perspective, if this is something that would pass, they also have to have in their mind the goal of this task force, right, which is, you know, when they're looking at additional power generation or modifications to power generation, they now also have to consider, you know, that it's affordable, local, and reliable, and diversifying it. So
having simple words like that would be huge.
I think so, too.
Latitude without...
Yeah. So it's not the same thing, but I think it's a passable potential statute change that would really give the commission some flexibility to evaluate that and to make decisions. Hopefully,
game changer. There were past commissions that, as I predict future scenarios, and all of them will be wrong in some large way or not, but. As you predict one, like predict that LNG gets imported at the lower end of the estimated cost. We're not there. We're not doing that, you know, yet. But if I were to enter into that and then somebody else comes along and says, well, I can provide you firm, you know, wind with storage at something higher than today's price, but lower than what I know and the commission doesn't know is going to be a future price, having the ability for them to make decisions based on prudent fuel supply mix, diversification, sustainability, reliability. It's not currently the way they're, now I think this commission might approve it, but there's no guarantee. You know, that's, I think they want, like we do, some certainty around some guidance. I don't know, I don't submit anything to the commission I don't think is going to get passed the first time through.
But I saved this from last week, what's up on the slide. Is this where you think the, you know, this language you've got?
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that, I think we really, as a committee, need to give the general public confidence that we are moving in that direction. I think there's a lot of skepticism because of, you know, history on, you know, where the rail bed has gotten and why we got here. And, you know, to Tony's point, that's because of a wide range of different things. But if they know that out of this subcommittee that that's the focus, and we're actually making some changes based on that, I think that will hopefully give the general public some confidence that we're moving the state in the right direction.
Are there some other words you might include in this, or are you just going to flesh that out?
I've got that here, and so I'll reflect that on the paper and okay. Submit that out. Yeah.
Okay. No, I think that's great. We're giving the RCA the tools that they need to reach their long-term goal. And yeah, John, appreciate you fleshing that out. I guess out of the incentive ideas, or are there other incentive, are there ones we like or don't like, or ones we like more, Tony?
Yeah, I think if it's a partnership, I don't mind, you know, when you set goals in the business, you know, they're typically, especially lower levels of the organization, you manage by objective. You know, here's what the end result looks like, and you come up with what you think the resources are going to be needed, and then you measure it, and you determine, you know, what did I achieve, exceed, not exceed, you know, why is that? You adjust course along the way. I don't have a problem with, you know, aspirational goals. I think that would be good, but, you know, at least internally, we define them as aspirational. Sometimes we qualify them with, you know, that, you know, they can't have a significant negative impact on rates, because I could achieve diversification tomorrow, but be rolling blackouts, right? Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't mind there being some skin in the game where it's based on the ability to, you know, access the funding. I don't want to speak for anyone in the legislature, especially the lieutenant governor here, but, you know, if the state was serious about, or if we had a sense that the three bodies were serious about participating in some meaningful way, whether it be a match or whatever it is, I mean, that to me would be a, you know, a great condition, because, you know, now I've got to be there to get it done, but if I can't get it done because, you know, rates are going to go up 10 cents or, you know, because I can't get the grant funding, or I can't get, you know, the interest rate. What I'm trying to avoid, what I see with the one failing of the current legislation, is I'm probably going to be in front of the commission spending $1 million a year explaining why I can't achieve something and why I want a waiver on, you know, on penalties, because supply chain issues are other things. And I don't think that the public really understands the challenges, or, you know, that we're experiencing in today's world with 3 years to get a transformer that's 380% more in cost than it was last year. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of thing that, you know, I don't want to be in front of the commission every, I don't think any utility wants to be, in, you know, hiring their attorneys to go in and adjudicate a process to waive a penalty that under the current construct could take, you know, it's a 45-day TA filing. Well, then there's going to be public comments. So now they're going to open a docket to investigate. RAPA is going to want to intervene. Other parties are going to want to intervene. I'm going to have stacked up 3 years of, you know, of some account that you ask for interim and refundable rates today, ask Chugach. They got an interim refundable increase on there, but they have to park it. They collect that increase, they have to park it, and if it turns out to the adjudication that it's not justified, they have to give it back plus 10.5% interest. I want to fund that. I mean, tell me where I can invest in somebody's, you know, 10.5%.
And Tony, to your point, I think it's when we talked about incentives versus penalties, it's what do we want people spending their time on? Finding short resources, right? And so if we're constantly going before the commission, you know, just debating penalties and this and that, when we could have been spending time on looking at new projects, you know, and so I guess actually, I want to hand it to Carl, but I'd also be curious to hear from Tony more about, I mean, what I'm hearing is somewhat of a high-level proposal, like maybe there's, you know, these goals or targets and they're rewarded if they're achieved. And so, but Carl, hand it to you.
Well, I want to hear that from Tony as well, but, you know, if Tony, if there's those existing penalties in place that you feel are punitive, what are they and how do we remove them? How do we remove those penalties?
Carl, they're not in place. It's just this is the second session in which they, you know, there's been legislation introduced.
Okay.
That's what I thought.
So we need a alternative, preferable, approach to present, so that draconian measure doesn't, see the light of day. Is that what we need?
Yeah, completely agree. And I think that just to say for out loud or for whoever's listening and on the record, I haven't seen one of these proposals that ultimately, I don't completely agree with it, and I can say that from, you know, what my board tells me as well. So the differences are the timing and the cost of how to get there, but the ultimate goal of being diversified, having regional security of energy at a lower cost that is that's carbon free. I mean, there's nothing there we don't agree with. It's just a matter of, you know, how you get there. So that's why, you know, I commend Jen for really coming up and approaching this from a perspective of, well, you know, what are the kinds of things you could do? So let me address that question. I'll get to the end first. I'm really not sure, but I'll give you an example. In the investor-owned world, I worked for a utility once prior to Alaska where its return on equity could go up by 0.5%. You know, there were four factors. They were incentive-based rates, so they're you know, the amount of return they could get on their equity would go up if they were in, say, the top quartile in safety or rates were in a certain quartile. And we have to be very careful about those metrics because I saw really unintended consequences, like if you could get a 0.5% increase in your return on equity, if you have zero lost time injuries, well, I watched that turn into supervisors driving the hospitals to pick up employees as they're about to enter the emergency room because, God forbid, that employee did not want to have to be accountable for that loss of that 0.5% of, you know, of additional equity. So with a cooperative, because everything is member-owned, I don't really know how I've yet to figure out, and I would be wide open to, you know, hearing how others, you know, what that is. You know, do you pay for additional employees? Well, I wouldn't necessarily support that. I think the utility is there to provide a service, and we have what it takes, and there are boards that are democratically elected to ensure that. But I have a hard time with a financial incentive because it's a direct. I can tell you that, and I'll just close on this thought. When somebody like me goes off to you know, a leadership program, and you're there to figure out like what is the thing you will defend the most, it typically comes down to member equity. That's what I'm a steward of. It's their equity in the utility, and with that, to provide that essential service.
I do think there's a balance with incentives, but I do think we can also look back at some of the things that prior legislators have done and what has passed in the state. And I think the Covenant Recovery Act does have some examples in there. Case in point, the storage facility that we operate and own today. So, you know, there was no incentive to get it across the finish line. You know, like, here, we'll give you, you know, payment for employees to work on it. We had to do all that ourselves. There was a tax incentive that was provided for the first couple of years to reduce the cost to the consumer. So, you know, we had to go forward with the project. We had to do all the research. We had to implement the project. We had to build it. And then once it was up and running, then we got the tax breaks. And so that, you know, that was a great, in my opinion, a great way to handle that, where you're not obligating the state to a bunch of projects that never go forward, mm-hmm. which is a concern, right? So there's probably things, you know, would be different for a co-op, but there's different things I think you could do along that line that would incentivize folks to get across the finish line.
Well, you raise a good point, John. This is Tony Izzo. If there's an incentive that's going to lower member costs, because, again, I can't raise, you know, I have to file quarterly with the commission. So we get scrubbed every quarter in terms of, you know, base rates in the SRF program and our COPA, our cost of power. Both those components are looked at on a quarterly basis. But if there's, you know, if you're talking about a tax abatement or reduction in permitting costs, that's a direct pass-through benefit to the member, and that motivates us.
And looks like Representative Rauscher has a comment as well. And Representative Rauscher, you're on mute.
I have that.
We can hear you. Thanks.
How was that? Thank you. So I appreciate the discussion. When it comes to penalties, I was wondering if penalties were low and stayed low, but yet enforced and only applied if the transmission and when the transmission lines were upgraded, would that be a problem still in the eyes of the utility companies, or would that be more something they would be inclined to appreciate and be able to work with better?
Representative Rush, this is John Sims. So I just want to make sure I understand your question. When you mentioned penalties about and the transmission lines. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, the users of those transmission lines are the co-ops that we have along the rail belt, and I think me as a ratepayer. I don't operate those facilities, but any kind of penalty, regardless of how large or how small, will ultimately impact my rates. And as a ratepayer, I would have a problem with that kind of legislation that would come down with a smaller fine per se. It's still impacting my rates, and so that would be my challenge with it. But I would defer to Tony.
Yeah, Tony
is,
for the record, Representative Rauscher, thank you for the question. I think if it were conditioned directly upon something like, you know, approval, a fiscal mode to facility that, and somehow the state and utility, you know, the co-ops, you know, as a representative or as any elected leader in the state, you represent constituents. And in many ways, my members are like my constituents, and, you know, they have us in place because there was no investor owned that was willing. And I can tell you in, you know, 20 years that I'm aware of, no investor owned has come and wanted to buy us either. So if the penalty was associated with a, you know, mutual, you know, conditioned upon the funding to facilitate that, and it wasn't set up in a way that we were spending 6 months of every year trying to get a waiver from the regulatory commission because of logistics or supply chain, then, you know, that would be fine. You know, I could see that, because I think you're talking about more of a partnership than you are trying to drive utility behavior that can only be paid for by the, you know, by the ratepayer, by the member.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying. I appreciate what you both have to say. I'm just trying to, I guess there's an overall atmosphere out there, and I don't think it's that, it's a secret or anything. But I think there's kind of, they want to make sure that something happens, they want to make sure that, that we're working toward lowering the cost, to the consumer as far as the rates that they're paying to their respective utility companies in the rail belt here. So I see where the need for a penalty may come in, but I'm trying to make it to where there's really no other excuse not to go and not to have done that already. So in other words, if the transmission lines are built by the state, or at least the match money is brought in by the state, or however we do it, or we've got grants or whatever, either way, they are built now, and they're at that point. And I guess along the way, we'd still be working on probably Bradley or something else going on. At that point, I think it would probably be the advantage to everybody to see us wanting to move ahead. And I guess they see that a small penalty of $20 is, I think, where we left off last time, was something that was somewhat agreeable. I'm not saying the $40 or whatever is in this, whatever is sitting on my desk right now, as far as the RPS is concerned. In fact, we're turning it in. The Energy Committee is probably going to be moving toward a CES more than an RPS. But anyway, I was just wondering if that would be looked on as a favorable idea, as long as we kind of moved all the hurdles out of your way to get to where we need to be able to put that fine levy in place at about $20, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, Representative Rauscher, this is Curtis with AEA. I think it's important to note that we're talking about new penalties, but nobody's talking about the fact the utilities have stepped up and are putting $12.5 million a year towards upgrades on the rail belt transmission line on the Kenai Peninsula. This also includes Golden Valley putting in money, and also for the BESs and for batteries. And so the utilities very well could have chosen not to put that $12.5 million, but they went out through AA and we bonded. And this is when the Bradley bonds were paid off. There was the ability of going in and doing required project work. We went through the Department of Law. We did this. The utilities committed to the $12.5 million for $166 million worth of bonding, which is in the bank. And so I guess my question is to me, why would we penalize the utilities and the ratepayers who are already investing $12.5 million for the next 28 years to do just what we're asking them to do? And I think that's lost by some of the critics, that they don't realize that work is already being done, already been committed to, and the utilities are already making that commitment, all the electrical utilities, from Homer Electric all the way to Golden Valley.
And I think I saw hands raised both from Tony and Carl.
Yeah, thank you. Carl, I've got Carl Hahnemann here, and I think as we look for the objective of trying to incent the good behavior, we have have to realize that we've got to do a lot more build out of the transmission system. I mean, more than what has been currently committed to, in order to even have the opportunity to bring potential new generation sources on wherever they're located within the rail belt. So we don't want to force utilities to bring on non-economic or non-affordable power that actually drive up rates. And, so we got to provide the infrastructure for them to have the opportunity to bring on systems that can potentially lower rates. And so in that context, as you said, I don't think any penalties are appropriate until that infrastructure build out,
is done, and it's going to take some state help, maybe some federal help to do it.
So you agree with me?
Well, I agree that no penalties are appropriate, certainly in the period of time where we don't have an opportunity to, you know, we've got to invest in our infrastructure first.
That's exactly what I said. I thought.
Yeah, great. But even in that context, then, once you have the infrastructure in place, I would disagree whether penalties or incentives or the approach. I think incentives are a much longer-term sustainable solution that have potentially to drive costs down because incentives are good behavior and doesn't penalize the ratepayer.
Can I hand
over
to Tony?
Yeah, Tony Uzzo, I agree with Carl and Representative Rauscher. I greatly appreciate your work in this effort. It's a huge improvement over what's been proposed in the past. I think I probably tend to get kind of mired in the some of the details of what we must what we go through just so that when people hit the switch, it's something you don't think about. But every time I look up at the, I think about the lights or anything that's manufactured, there's lunch in the room I see over there, and that was made maybe 30 minutes ago. Well, the lights in the room were made, a millisecond ago. It's instantaneous, I'm concerned about penalties, which we've taken a look at one of the prior proposals that could increase rates by almost $34 million a year for MEA members. That's, compared to our $45 million a year fuel supply contract. And it's significant. That assumes, though, that, we can't make any progress. I think we can make progress, but it needs to be thoughtful. It needs to be, we need to consider the supply chain and the logistics to get anything constructed. Regulatory Commission right now has an open, iDocket that is looking at information on renewable, RPS and, clean energy standards. I testified, last week, as did some of the other utilities. I think it's impressive to see what, has been done and what's moving forward. If the state has, a stake in this, as you've described, I don't think it's something that I would necessarily oppose, but, would certainly want to watch as things developed, and we saw what kind of time and effort it took to actually facilitate a place where we could where solely the decision was based on the utility to make a common sense economic reliability decision or pay a penalty. It's just going to take a lot of infrastructure to get us there.
Okay. Isaac
Henry 6. Hi, Isaac Vandenberg, Lunch Alaska. Don't want to take us off on a different topic, and this conversation has been fascinating. I am wondering, as a kind of interloper from the incentives and subsidies committee, and not having been a part of all the conversations that you'll have had, is this subcommittee's, has there been a conversation around customer side resources or what some people call demand resources, and thinking about, the U.S. In 2022, I saw, the U.S. spent $10 billion a month on things like electric vehicles and storage for their homes and solar panels and all these app-enabled appliances in their homes that, are a certain sort of resource. And has this subcommittee, had conversations? Are they thinking about how do we start thinking about setting ourselves up so that some of those demand-side resources are actually part of the puzzle here and take some of the pressure off of, sending electrons 700 miles, their way to send electrons from one neighborhood to the next in an area, and a apologize. I was going through the notes and trying to find any discussion, but and feel free to say that's not the topic, and we're going to talk about the topic at some other point, but I just wanted to ask the question and get some thoughts.
Yeah, Tony is a great question, Isaac. I think the that is certainly a fascinating aspect of what I think the future will bring. One of the things I would point out that you know, this committee has talked about is the need to, you know, likely to achieve the affordability or the, you know, reduction in rates, the need to grow the denominator. That's not to say at the expense of conservation or at the expense of some other thing. The transmission aspect of it is looked to be a key way, based on the Iceland model, to facilitate, you know, industrial growth that could help reduce rates or put downward pressure on rates. I think the other side of it is the utility operator. This isn't a response. This isn't, you know, code for, we shouldn't think about what you just described. I think we have to. But in my system, we have a system that we can afford and that we deserve. I believe in both of those. And the distribution system, at 15% EV proliferation in the valley, I have serious infrastructure needs at the distribution level. I don't have residential transformers that I'm scrambling to find, because we're adding 1,200 meters a year. They're undersized. They just don't cut it. Line size from home to home, it just isn't, you know, doesn't cut it. So it's probably an exponential economic aspect, and something that I'm in discussions with Gwen Holdman and ASEP on is they're fascinated by this, and, you know, I think university can help us with some analysis on, you know, what does that mean? We want beneficial electrification, but if it's, you know, if it's going to help lower rates, but I've got to spend, you know, two times the capital in infrastructure, it's going to have the opposite effect. That it's a matter of getting the right things in the right order.
And so, that's a great question. We actually did. Aaron raised that question in our discussions. And for me personally, as a committee member, and this is for the benefit of the folks that are online and can't see this, we actually came up with three sort of terms of focus, right? The short term, minimize your grid costs while meeting supply needs. Over the midterm, public investment and infrastructure to enable the long-term goal. And I think most importantly, the long-term, significant diversification of energy supply that is affordable, local, and reliable. So as a committee member specifically tasked with looking at power generation transmission, the one thing that's difficult for me to get my arms around is how would an incentive like that, how can we control the individual investment decisions towards those goals there? And so I think it's definitely worth talking about in incentives and subsidies, absolutely, because that definitely can be a midterm piece that helps us to enable the long-term goal. So I think it's definitely possible and potential for Alaska, but in this committee, I didn't necessarily personally think that it fit for our discussions. So I definitely think it's worth the time, though.
And I'll offer, thank you, John, and thank you, Isaac, for the question. I'll offer that I think the demand piece of it, or demand response, demand choice, is perhaps missing in our subcommittee structure. And I think, one, we could use your question as a segue to the demand topic that we thought we would talk about today from on your agenda. But in terms of where, if we come up with some ideas, where those might actually end up in our final report, you know, right now it says rail belt transmission, generation, and storage. And demand is not in there. So I wonder if it goes in incentives and subsidies, but maybe that's farther down the line.
This is Jen for the record. Yeah, we did have we did capture demand as a discussion topic, and we didn't get to it during our last meeting, and so we did want to talk about, looking at, ideas to increase the denominator, or potentially you have a time of use rate that helps move, spread demand out so we don't have to do as many upgrades. Anyway, so we do have that as a discussion topic. We just haven't gotten to it yet. And maybe before we go to it, I guess I would just like to kind of poll the subcommittee on just the different ideas that have been discussed, and if folks could kind of just weigh in on ideas we like or don't like to maybe kind of close out this discussion.
Yeah, and that was the other thing I was going to mention. I'd be happy to take on the diversification incentive idea as a, kind of in the same model as the Cook Inlet Recovery Act that we had, and I'd ask for some assistance from Tony's perspective to just to get a sense as to what would make the most sense from an incentive for them. It may not be tax credits that is the most effective, but I can take a stab at taking that on, and if you want to add that to mine, I'd be happy to.
So you're
going to
write the little white paper.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Yes. Okay. And I'll work with Tony.
And this would, I will attach this to that generation idea.
I think that's the biggest idea to come out of, as far as the central theme. I did want to just test, these are smaller things, but how does the group feel about, there's the Renewable Energy Fund. Do you just continue to use that to support new generation project development, or do we have something targeted towards new generation projects? And then secondly, the Power Project Loan Fund. That's been a great mechanism, but it is one that's, the funding's a lot of it's been used. I just wanted to get feedback on those ideas.
I guess my thought is Curtis. We have two programs that work very well, and so rather than create a new one, maybe it's just some suggestions for augmenting it, and we could even do that by, let's say, the Power Project Fund, where a certain amount of projects have to be funded below a certain level and, over something. I think there's some adjustments within the fund, within those two programs, statutorily, that would probably get easier to pass and to be easier to digest than create something from the bottom up.
That's a great point. And administration-wise, there's already teams that are running those programs. So, Carl, thanks.
Yeah, Carl Hahnemann here. I was going to say as well that I think the augmenting Power Project Fund provides financing under certain contexts is maybe appropriate. I also like Tony's idea of incentivizing transmission interconnects for new projects. At the point that we have a base transmission system that can handle it, because I think that would allow projects to think broader context geographically, optimization, and that they could then, if they come to the table with a project that's, lower than the, average base rail belt cost or something, so it meets some criteria of driving costs down, they could be confident of some sharing of the transmission interconnect for that. I think that would be a good thing. And maybe it comes through the Project Power Fund as well. I mean, it could just be a, but I think, because long term, we can see that we need to take advantage of our local resources where they exist and bring those to the grid cost effectively, and there might be some incentive that would help do that.
Tony?
Yeah, I completely agree, and just bother to make the point or emphasize the point that if the state or the federal government are putting funds towards the kinds of things we're talking about, these are not, the good news, bad news, but the good news is the utilities are consumer owned, and the benefits flow right through to the consumer. There's no, there's no overhead that gets tacked on for, some transmission system gets built in NEA's system. There's no margin that gets added to the operation and maintenance of that. So you have labor contracts and other things, but those are just direct costs that get, you know, passed through on a quarterly or reviewed on a quarterly basis. So I think when I get excited about us talking about like a transmission system, that, you know, I think it benefits if you're an independent power producer and you have the ability now to bring something on that can go from one end to the other end of the system with a postage stamp rate that's potentially just for the operation and maintenance, and you're not dealing with some double-digit, you know, wheeling charge on a per megawatt hour basis. I mean, the benefits flow, you know, they benefit us through fuel supply diversification. The benefit is reliability. The benefit is lower cost. And there's no part of that that, you know, ends up in some, you know, power utilities, you know, bottom line or return to shareholders. Your capital credits don't go up any higher, et cetera. That's how I like looking at this. You know, because if it's going to benefit, if it's going to be a winners and losers kind of thing, I have difficulty with that.
Thanks, Tony. And John, I think you wanted to just bring up the RCA language and being able to evaluate multiple metrics on a project.
Yeah. So, Chair Kerber, since here, thanks for joining us. So We had a long, healthy discussion, and I'm not going to ask for your response, just for your consideration to take back. And in those discussions, we came up with the long-term sort of focus of significant diversification of energy supply that is affordable, local, and reliable. And we were trying to figure out, as a committee, how to make that happen and whether or not adding language to existing statute that the commission could consider as they're presented to different projects across the rail belt, if they were asked to make consideration on whether or not that was heading, you know, moving us in the right direction of diversification of energy supply that is affordable, local, and reliable. So, and what made me think of that was during the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, there was language that modified statute that suggested that the commission must evaluate the ramifications of saying no to a gas supply contract. And so similar mindset, as they're presented with this potential generation for the rail belt, is that steering us in the right direction? Conceptually, sometime in the future, I would be interested to know the commission's position on whether or not that would be helpful or whether or not that would be harmful to the end goal of that diversification focus.
So this is Keith Kerber from the RCA for the record, and being more of a visual than audio learner, I'm seeing this for the first time, and I'm really grateful. And I was just going to suggest or also act it, just as I did the walkabout to the other committees, at least one person from y'all, maybe the our meeting in the readout room in the afternoon, to maybe sort of clarify that a little bit more, because I think what you're speaking to, John, was brought up several times by Tony with respect to, you know, 20 years ago, which nobody is on the commission now who was there 20 years ago, right? And that was a long time ago, but there were some serious concerns about commission action, or rather inaction. I think that was how it was assessed. And they could have, they may have had some long-term or short-term ramifications on natural gas supply contracts. And, you know, as we talk about the issue of securing our energy future, and we've been focusing on the, you know, kilowatt hour cost as a metric, I think that what you're discussing brings up an issue that I know is very at the heart of a couple of commissioners, and that is the whole issue of fuel. Okay, how do we fuel the generation to create the amount of electrons we need to do all the things that we're suggesting across the various subcommittees? So my initial reaction is like anything. Hey, I'm of course we'll take a look at it. The thing that I always like to remind people here, not, you know, because people are forgetful of it, but because we have also outside people listening in, is that we can produce or place statutory or legislative proposals into the legislature. but oftentimes it's been, I think it's our assessment at the subcommittee, and I'm not, I have one of the co-chairs listening in, is that the larger statutory fixes that are going to come out of this are not going to really be dealing with the RCA. I'm not saying it won't. I'm just saying that it's going to be the, can we get legislative / executive branch buy-in on a large project that looks to be very beneficial to the state of Alaska, or multiple large projects. So that's, that's where I'm coming from on this. And always willing as part of the process to do whatever's requested to take a look at something to hopefully get to the end goal of the task force's purpose. I hope that I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the response. The concern that I have, and we've talked about this a number of times, is, I think we all believe as a committee that it's important for the state of Alaska to move towards more diversification in our energy supply. And the challenge that we see is, let's say, for example, we find in the future that natural gas is 50 cents cheaper than some sort of renewable, or don't even place it as renewable, just say other diversified power generation. If you have a long-term goal of being diversified, how do you ensure that happens with current regulations and statutes? And that's the challenge we see is, right now, as utilities, cheaper is the way we go. But is that in the best interest of the state moving forward over the long term? So that's what we want. We want to try and give the commission the tools to consider the long-term vision that we should be having as a state, as opposed to the immediate challenges. So that's the...
Can I just respond very quickly? And I think that this, speaking to the issue of fuels, is do we put the king's X on any kind of fuel at this point? We're proliferating a lot of technologies that can take a fuel that perhaps at this present time is not viewed as the best fuel. I'm thinking about a fuel that we have in abundance in the interior, which is coal. Are there technologies either present or coming that could help make that cleaner than it's currently viewed? And should we just say we're not going to even look at that? And I'm not... It's very important that I say here for the record that I don't speak for the commission. I'm just one guy on the task force. I want to make sure everybody's clear about that. But it's just one of those things that, or even the notion of nuclear, advanced nuclear. So I take your points to heart, and I look forward to hopefully taking something with me when I get back, or at least get an email, from somebody to be able to socialize with my colleagues. But I would just say also one last thing. It's been talked about before that, we have a deadline, we have a calendar, we have a target, a task that we have to accomplish by a certain date, but our movement in terms of, saying, hey, the commission, which is five people, not one, says this, that's a longer term process, and it's harder to just, the likelihood of getting anything before the end of this task force is not likely, but at least what I feel is we're getting guidance that can help inform future actions on our part to explore these things. Similarly, what Tony's already addressed in, his sort of testimony, and I mean that in a broader sense, not here at the table, but from being at a public meeting last week that I think was very robust in discussing some issues that we are very very interested in building a record on. Okay? So I'll leave it at that. Thank you. Thank you. I didn't anticipate talking this much. I'm so busy to deserve, but you all put my organization on the board, so I hope I answered your question.
Thank you very much. Okay, so it's 11:55, and I believe we're breaking for lunch at noon. And so we'll blame it on you. We didn't get through the agenda. But I actually think we had a really good discussion that around that incentive and incentive for diversification, and we hit on some of the points on our midterm goals as well. So out of that discussion, John is going to draft an incentive for diversification similar to what's been done in the past that could help offer a carrot instead of a stick. And I could take a stab at augmenting the power project fund in REF and share that with you, Curtis.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great, because I'm not the expert on those programs, but just, I can do so in the incentive space. I think those are some of the core ideas we came up with. John?
When you're finished.
Okay. And then, so I think the things we didn't get to is having that demand-side discussion. I don't think we have time to do it justice today. And so I propose that we move that to our Monday meeting, if that works for the group. And then I guess that's just a test. Does the group feel like we still need to brainstorm on these short, mid, and long-term goals, or do we feel like we've hit a lot of those already in our discussion?
I think we've hit a lot of them, and I think we could probably, once we see all the white papers, probably quickly come up with the timeline. If for some reason we think the timeline is off, that's it.
Okay, perfect. Okay, John?
So just so I understand the day and the schedule, are we taking an hour break for lunch, or are we doing a working lunch?
The idea was to have people time to respond to emails. That was an hour lunch.
Okay.
Unless people want to come back, but we were going to go into the subcommittees next, the second or
so.
Yeah, if we want to do the demand discussion, we could.
I was going to say, if we're taking an hour break, I more than likely won't be here. I'll be going back to the office, so.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Okay, so.
15 or 20 minutes, but who would
love to just. So maybe let's take 5 minutes to pick out our favorite lunch and then come back for demand.
Yeah, okay,
thanks, guys. Okay. All right. Thank you so much. This is Jen Miller for the record. The Rail Belt Subcommittee has elected to continue working through lunch, and so we wanted to have a discussion on in the demand space. And I think there's multiple topic areas, but one is around looking at the Iceland model and how I think they quadrupled their demand by bringing heavy industry to the state or to the country, and using that to increase the denominator and spread out the fixed costs of energy costs and use that as a mechanism to reduce costs. Another topic area has been around as we electrify or switch to electric vehicles and increase demand that way, we've heard concerns around infrastructure. So is there an idea around time of use rates that might help spread out that demand? And so I think we should treat this how I think we've been really productive in this brainstorm space. And so I think let's not structure this too much and let folks kind of share different ideas and concepts. John?
So I have a question with what you just said there, because my understanding of the Iceland situation is a little different from, and I don't know much about this, but I'm generally genuinely asking the question. So my understanding is that industry came in once the rates were lowered. Is that not correct?
Others heard the conversation or discussion as well, but what I understood is that they strategically said, we're going to target the aluminum smelting industry and try and hold them in, and we're going to, they had a line of sight, they said, we're going to increase our grid capability and go after heavy industry at the same time to,
to
spread out rate costs.
Yeah, I wonder, I mean, it would be a tough sell regardless without a lower cost of energy. So I'm very curious to see if that was truly, they brought them in with the high cost and then was able to be reduced, or how that.
I think they promised them a low cost.
It promised them a low cost.
So, you know, that's how I recall it. It was an overall strategic effort.
Okay.
You know, eliminate constraints to lower rates, but one component of that was, We need to increase the denominator, or we need to increase sales. I think probably the most recent example that, you know, we would compare it to is when you hear about the cost of like a for-profit bullet line, you know, model versus what if the state were to export large volumes and then Alaskans was just to take off a small stream. The economy as a scale is so great. And so to the point of the question, I think it was a concerted effort all the way around. And I really have felt that the transmission recommendation, you know, you'll see, I plan to address something there, you know, have a bullet or, something that really should be a coordinated effort to also facilitate, you know, some growth if we want to get to affordability. Otherwise, we're just paying for maybe a more efficient system. We'll get the benefit of economic development across the rail, or economic dispatch from one end of the rail belt to the other. Those are benefits, but frankly, we'd have those today if they were economic.
And Carl?
Yeah, I just want to say, John, and confirm, I mean, with my understanding of the mining industry, I'm sure, and I was aware at the time of their kind of strategic decision to build those big hydro projects with, you know, power sales agreements to the big smelters, and they both, you know, they built their smelters while the power projects were underway, and it came together. It's only, you know, if only Alaska could aspire to that kind of strategic thinking and initiatives.
Well, so this is John. Sorry to interrupt if I did, Carl. There's an important thing that we could take away from that to go to Carl's question about the strategic aspect of it. And the thing that I've always been challenged with is cost overruns. So who pays for the project overruns on a promised rate of power? Is that the Icelandic government that took that on? Was that the ratepayer? Who had to pay for the difference for any cost overrun? That, because we could do some really amazing things getting industry in here, but you have the project risk of cost overruns, and especially in this market, that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if they did, but if
yeah, I don't know the details on that.
that's pretty important.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know what was done. I always think, man, there's, you know, such an incentive. If you're accountable for the cost overrun, it definitely helps decrease the likelihood of the cost overrun. we do a lot of lump sum contracts, and you better believe I hustle to hold that price so I have a profit margin. But I understand that that's tricky on a co-op utility side, because then who ultimately carries the overrun is the public. I guess the question though would be is if the load growth was large enough that it was overall decreasing rates, you'd still get, maybe you wouldn't get the benefit, full benefit that you thought, but maybe you get a lot of it because you have more of a shared cost. So I think that's a question. Tony?
Excuse me, Jen. You just remind me of something I think we should consider. John brings up an excellent point, because it's, you know, there's the regulatory compact, which, yes, we're held, you know, accountable to do the right things and providing essential services and monopoly. But on the other hand, you know, part of the regulatory compact is that the commission, if Chair Kerber were here, I'm sure he would agree, is to ensure that the utility is healthy, you know, is has rates in place that it can be healthy. It's very difficult in our small market to punish bad behavior in that regard. If you were to overbuild generation, for example, on Lower 48, with an investor-owned utility, you'd say, look, I'm not going to allow you to collect that $100 million, you know, that can't be in your revenue requirement. You're going to have to go off and, you know, market that thing on your own. Your ratepayers are not going to pick that up. So there have been some changes, the RRC, the project pre-approval, to address that kind of thing or eliminate that kind of thing. But cost overruns are, you know, they're going to run right to the ratepayer. And I think what we ought to be also thinking about is, if we want to attract large industry, I won't pretend to speak for any other utility, so I'll just use NEA as an example. But if there was large industry that came into somewhere within our certificated area, and a deal was struck that to provide, first of all, I don't have the power generation available right today for that, I would try to get it from others on the constrained relative transmission grid. But let's say it was large enough that something new had to be built. If it were new, lower cost, if it was renewable, whatever it is, I think we should consider dedicating that to just that industry for some period of time. And you got to be careful about cross subsidies, right? I mean, any of us regulated utilities are, that's something we're constantly under review, is rate classes. You know, is your commercial section, are they subsidizing your residential or vice versa? You can't have that. But if there's no cross subsidy, I would say that even though rates don't go down because of immediately because of that new industry, it's going to bring to the community jobs, and there's going to be an infusion of capital into the region that we would benefit from. So as a not-for-profit utility, I just think it's something we should be looking at in terms of attracting industry.
I like that as an incentive to say, your first right of refusal to this new generation source, because we're trying to attract new business to Alaska. And then once that new generation source is paid off, then maybe everyone shares in the benefit of that load growth.
Yeah, as long as we're in the brainstorming phase, I have to just point out that one way to encourage industry is to attract industry from outside the state. That actually is quite difficult to do. It can be done, but is a challenging thing. Another kind of approach to this is just growing some of the assets that we have in the state, and that world I'm quite excited about. Ted Stevens. Some of the sector coupling opportunities that we have, where you can look at some of our largest economic players who are currently bringing fuel in from outside the state, and what if we can start thinking about, as aviation moves towards, don't want to pick the technology, but I think it's going to go towards, renewable or zero carbon sources of fuel. Can we produce that here to meet the demand that is starting to materialize at Ted Stevens or Port of Alaska? Maritime and shipping is one of the sectors that's really hard to decarbonize. And if we have the ability to start, supplanting some of the fuels that those large shippers are using, that could be money that stays inside the state rather than going outside the state. So I just think looking at some of those current industries that we have that are poised for decarbonization or electrification is a massive load growth or massive, industry growth opportunity that we have here, and we should be looking at those.
Thank you for that, Isaac. I'll just add, I also think mining processing could be a route. I've spoken with mining development companies that, have plans to send their ore out simply because the cost of electricity and the cost of power is prohibitive here. So they're sending it, out to other states, and as much as they would want to process it here. So putting that on the table as well.
John?
So I think looking at both are critical. For those existing, I know it's been important to, the FedExes of the world, those that are making massive investment at the airport, is because they've seen the long-term stability of rates and understand that, at least for NSTAR, we've got that security for, 10 years out here. So stability, I think, is critical and an important component to that. And going back to the original point of Iceland is how do we, and I think we should definitely explore this, how do we give both existing and external organizations an opportunity to understand what that cost is going to be over the long term, and then set that price to draw them in or to allow them to increase it. Again, reiterating the challenge of that is what happens to the any price overruns. Cost underrun, cheaper project cost is easy, but the overruns is, maybe we could do something in that light to try and promote business growth, period, whether it's internal or external.
And John, what I'm hearing you say is, if someone were looking at, do I want to site my manufacturing facility in Alaska right now, they're looking at existing rates. And so how do we give them a market indication of what it could be for, maybe it's like that certain amount of demand, you get a preferred rate or something. So they would have some sort of economic indicator?
Yeah, and so it's kind of, it's almost counterintuitive. I think what's more important than cheaper rates is consistency of rates. Because if I'm an analyst looking at revenue over the long term, I need to understand that those are going to be consistent so I can accurately forecast my models. And so if we can just give consistency of rates over the long term, these businesses that are looking at developing in the state can understand what those costs are up front, and then they can build their business models from that point on. So that consistency is what's critical.
Thank you, Carl.
Yeah, Carl Hahnemann here. Yeah, if I was, you know, step back and try to have think big, to John's point, consistency, you know, what do we have in the state that could do that? And, you know, if we look at our stranded gas assets on the North Slope, you know, whether that comes, look at the Alaska LNG project, you know, if what that could do for the state in terms of consistency over the next generation or two, and then that allows you to, you know, ship some of that natural gas out to Donlin through their gas pipeline to create generation out in, you know, western Alaska, then could be distributed to a whole bunch of communities. And it, you know, could really change the look of Alaska in terms of our capacity and stability and ultimately, you know, lower rates. I mean, that Cook Inlet study showed, you know, 4.4 to 5.8 bucks a million is, you know, there's nothing else that could even touch that. And cost overruns are a factor. I understand a project of that scale and scope. But you could absorb some cost of those overruns and still have that be the, you know, the lowest cost option for Alaska over a long term. So, I encourage us to think about, you know, how to advocate for mobilizing that stranded gas asset that we have. And that then provides the center pin and the foundation under which the strength of the rest of the diversification can happen. Because we will have that stability.
Can I see Dan White also
has
his hand raised?
Yeah, thanks. And I've joined this committee off and on, but so I apologize if this already been discussed. But I mean, I guess I continue to hope that we're able to focus on kind of energy and the cost of energy in its different forms, because we spend a lot of time talking about power. And unless we're going to use power for transportation and for heating, unless we're using electrons for heating, I think we're kind of missing part of this, the whole energy portfolio. And I was just thinking about Mr. Guy's comments this morning about, you know, economic development in rural Alaska, and Aaron's comments just a second ago on ore process. About economic development, if we don't have an affordable heating source, something that can be mobilized and transported, you know, we've got another problem. And cheap electricity is beneficial, but not the solution. So I guess it just encourages us to continue to think about transportation and heat as a part of this puzzle. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. And we did, in our last work session last week, we did expand our scope to not just look at electricity, but also to look at the heat side as well. We haven't so far included transportation. I guess, yeah, are there any comments in response to Dan's related to on the heat side? I mean, if something we'll just keep in mind.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jen, Tony Izzo, maybe I'm just a little slow, but I've heard Carl make, you know, he makes a good statement, a clear, I think, what sounds to me more like a proposal around developing North Slope resources or natural gas resources. As an electric utility, as a state resident, I think that would be great in terms of economic development, in terms of security supply of natural gas. That would be great. It doesn't, it might help me moderate rate increases to some degree, but it doesn't change the need to diversify, in my opinion. But is there a Carl, is there a recommendation, or Jen, is there a recommendation that we should be putting together around gas supply from the North Slope? I'm looking at John, I guess.
Well, Jen can share that I did prepare a draft of our short-term, medium-term, long-term goals, and for your consideration, I did propose that we look first to AKLNG and second to the in-state owned line as part of that, the foundation on which our long-term goals could be successful. She was interested in discussing it further and getting feedback and whether or not we should mention specific projects or not. And which I do specifically think in that regard we should, because we have to let the Alaskan public know that in our analysis, that the only way to get there from here that we see is that in terms of stability.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. And I'll just elaborate. Yeah, so Carl did a really nice job putting a one-pager together, which we asked for, and we'll share with the group at the end of the week. That, you know, gave the context around the discussion that we had for the short, mid, and long-term goals. And then our comments back and forth were just around, he pulled in the Alaska LNG project as part of that. And my question was, you know, I guess my personal view is if we're setting the context at the high level, I'd like to keep that project agnostic and leave it out of the high level goals. And then if this subcommittee has a specific recommendation around Alaska LNG, I think it should be its own thing and not tied to the general context setting. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I'm open to that, Jen, if that's, you know, that structure, but in some fashion I believe that we need to be bold.
That's one reason I agree. I just think of it in context of heat. There's, you know, I still break it down into the short term, mid term, long term, and
right.
With, you know, there's almost nothing that could be built in time for me to avoid the need for natural gas. And even if the current, you know, without discussing penalties or components of it, but even if the RPS legislation as currently written were to pass and I were to able to achieve that in 2040, it takes me from about 6 billion cubic feet a year to somewhere north of 2 billion cubic feet a year of natural gas that I still need. So it's a, you know, from an internal perspective, we are hard charging at both things.
I mean, I don't know how the rest of the subcommittee feels, but I'm fine. I mean, Carl, maybe that's its own separate one-pager on the Alaska LNG, both from a heat and electricity side and how that ties in. Any other thoughts from the subcommittee?
Just for a second, I'd want to make sure is that not only do they see the benefit to South Central, but also the benefit to Fairbanks to have that transmission line go through there. It's important to the Fairbanks community and would definitely, you know, potentially lower their costs and give them a guaranteed supply behind a pipe as opposed to a truck.
Well, but if we build the line that we should, then it gives gas offtake opportunities for all over Alaska, you know, and Donlin is just the kind of outside investment that we want to make with a credible large third party that could build that infrastructure, and suddenly you'd have gas and electrification, you know, 300 miles west.
No, I'm agreeing with you, Carl.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess, Carl, are you okay taking a pass at that one pager?
Sure.
Would that fall under generation or how?
Yeah. I guess, would you guys think we'd stay under generation?
Well,
I think kind of as we've talked about it, it is its own category, but it also helps with one component of the diversification of energy supply. I think as we discussed last time, natural gas is going to be a form of power generation for the foreseeable future. So we have to address that in some way, shape, or form. So it's a combination of the two, I think.
And we can always, I think what we said too, is we take a look at all the individual action summaries, and then we'll kind of figure out how to conglomerate and summarize them. Does that sound good? Okay. And then as far as the demand discussion that we're having, I guess, Aaron, I know you expressed an interest in doing one of the one pagers. Is that something you'd be interested in taking a run at?
Roger that. Would love to have lots of robust discussion and ideas to fold into that, though.
Aaron's just going to take the demand.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And is that the demand side management aspect of it, or is that what is that?
And I guess, or what I was asking specifically is we had a discussion around load growth ideas.
Okay.
Mark captured as we were going through some talking points, and so just taking that and cracking it into a recommendation. And maybe we're probably not done with that discussion, but I just kind of wanted to march along.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think you have valuable perspectives as someone in the private sector and who thinks maybe not as governmentally centric as I'm leaning more towards these things, but I would love to hear some of your suggestions, not to put you on the spot, for demand strategies.
Sure. I don't feel put on the spot because it's what we do all the time. But I'm very excited just in broad terms about the aviation sector and the opportunities there and shipping, as I said earlier. I'm also very interested, in kind of behind the meter demand growth. I know that's something that's very, very clear to a lot of folks, but I just see that happening faster than we can really catch up with it. And that includes things like heat pumps. I mean, I have neighbors now, and that, electricity prices where they are today, we're putting in heat pumps plus solar, and it pencils out even at today's electricity prices.
That's locally?
Here locally, yeah. Anchorage, because they're, they put up solar, bring their effective electricity cost around 13 cents per kilowatt hour. On average over the year. It's all of a sudden the heat pumps start working. On the industrial side, just heat processing,
on the rail belt?
I'm not scoping this to the rail belt. I guess I'm thinking more statewide.
Mm-hmm.
I think those areas, just kind of light-duty transportation, heavy-duty transportation, aviation, heat, those areas in general, I just think there's a ton of growth, low growth.
Are there specific sort of incentives or carrots that you see from a...
I know in...
About what those businesses want?
I know in other places, which I think this is in the future category for us, but where you see aggregation of demand side resources that are bidding into wholesale markets, which I'm aware that we don't have at the moment in Alaska, but where you'll have 5,000 power walls that are aggregated and bid in to provide storage to a utility. There's dozens and dozens of those demonstration projects happening in other parts of the country. Any kind of app-enabled appliance, hot water heaters, EVs, like those things can all be aggregated. And if we have in my neighborhood, which is not, necessarily a good indicator of the state, I don't know the numbers, but we have, four Ford F-150 trucks that are sitting in people's driveways, that those are pretty good sized batteries. And they have backup potential for their home, but they're not, you know, at the moment providing any kind of service to the grid. So all sorts of time of use rates, allowing customers to be compensated for providing those services to the grid. FERC Order 2222 is an interesting thing that we don't really have an Alaska version of, but where we're essentially, providing safe harbor for any of those affordable appliances to backfeed into the grid up to 15% of the, total, switch capacity, essentially. I just see the utility scale generation industry is super exciting. Also, I think we need to not take our eye off the ball with some of the residential stuff. I mean, that number, $10 billion a month last year, the U.S. spent on these, individual consumers, Alaska, residents are spending this stuff to put it in their homes, and those are just sitting there, and they're not providing any service yet. And at some point, it seems like people who are getting these things in their homes are going to start to have a conversation about how do I get paid for that. And that $10 billion a month is going to, increase. It's going to be interesting to see what the 2023 numbers are. Those are resources that we should be activating somehow. I can also help you think through this on the fly here, come up with some things that come to that.
I just wanted to add, I guess in my brain, the earlier discussion was kind of all about increasing the denominator. And I think it's a good segue into demand management and tools and resources. And so I just wonder if I want to segue our conversation on the demand management side and see if folks have some additional ideas. Kind of two different parts of the paper is what I'm thinking, Karen. Right. Tony?
Yeah, I think I certainly agree. I think I did spot on. It's maybe a question and then a comment, but where do you see that in the timeline, short-term, mid-term, long-term, fitting in? And I'm probably too close to it, but, I'm in a, I explained to the commission last week at a public meeting around the fact that I'm just inside 4.5 years of natural gas supply. That represents 84% of the energy we provide. And I think the expression, based on my commentary was that it sounded like I was putting my co-op on a wartime footing. And I agreed with that categorically. I mean, not literally, but this is a significant moment in time. It's probably the last time NEA went through anything like this that came close in scale was when it decided to self-generate. And it's notified Chugach at the end of this agreement to provide power. And so then there was this window between, okay, I've said no, they're not buying any more fuel to generate power for me, and this day that I have to generate it or I'm in trouble. That would be the closest comparison, kind of a generational shift that we're into. And so when I think about resources and the limited size of our system, we may be forced into a situation, I think we are, where we've got to triage the really big things first in the short term and simultaneously prepare ourselves for the future. One of the things that we're dealing with right today that I think every utility spoke to the commission last week is, as the proliferation of net metering increases, you're going to see the amount of subsidy paid for by those that don't net meter, that don't self-generate, is going to go up. And we're all facing that in the very near term, having to at least communicate, if not actually file rate designs, so that if you're connected to the system, you're still paying some share of that overall infrastructure, including the generation, if you want to switch off. Personally, I think the huge disruptor that's, you know, coming, I don't know if it'll be during my career time, but whether it be Tesla or somebody else is going to come up with some box, it's probably not lithium ion. It's probably, you know, MIT tells me we're at the limit with that, but it's going to be some kind of a battery that can, you know, just get mounted on your wall in your garage. And with whatever you, whether it be solar panels or some other thing, you're going to be able to store 3 months of power. And that's the moment where people will disconnect from the utility, and you will see rapid, significant increases in rates for those remaining. You know, it's going to create a massive imbalance. I'm sure we can avoid all that since we know it's coming anyway at some point, but it'll be fascinating to watch.
For example, that's a recommendation for Utah.
Yeah, there's systems that we would need in place to, you know, I'd have to install another 70,000 meters. I mean, the software, the cyber, the interconnectivity, I'm just so close to it that I'm thinking about the, I love the idea and I like to talk about that kind of thing. And then the minute I come into, okay, how do I actually connect and implement that? And the capital and the time and the supply chain, I go, oh my God. I need to keep the lights on in 4.5 years. I have no time for.
Yeah, and just fascinating points. And on the longs, I just an anecdote on the long term storage, you know, seasonal storage. I told Playdeck recently there's, you know, 100 plus companies in the U.S. right now that are coming up with these, you know, alternative chemistries for. Or including one that's just going through our program right now that has a you know, sandstone chemistry, and they're claiming, you know, 6 months storage that's cheaper than some of the off the shelf technologies you can use today. It's a startup, so you know, it's luck to be proven. But it is, I guess the point I'm making is all the challenges that you're voicing are real, and that at the same time, people aren't just buying things and putting them up, and they want to be compensated for those. And it's something that we can't really control. And you know, we just need to be thoughtful about how we are incorporating these technologies as they're being put on, because they're really going to more quickly. It's almost like we need good data to understand exactly how fast it's happening, but by the time we study it, it's already passed. It's just moving so quickly, it's past our ability to comprehend. So, yeah, and I don't know if there's a recommendation. I imagine your group has addressed this already, but just the, investments in substations and smart meters and panel upgrades and distribution lines and feeder lines, and all of this stuff, to me, is going to be as necessary as the big stuff, you know, the large transitional things. So.
I think we've primarily been focused kind of at the macro level and large scale generation. One thing we did want to talk about is, one thing I certainly want to talk about is, you know, EV adoption is happening, and we also know that we could have limitations on our distribution system. With that increased demand, and so, you know, and I don't know enough in the mechanics or the details, you know, should we be structuring a time of use rate so that people will charge at night when other demands are not online, or, you know, how do we spread out that demand just so that we don't hit infrastructure bottlenecks before we need to and have to try and reduce what that upgrade cost is or when it happens? Tony?
Yeah, that's a tool in the toolbox, and the NEA is very close to filing its time of use rate. You know, why would we want to build additional generation if you can, you know, it's a win-win to push behavior into these off-peak periods. It actually helps the overall system. And so there's an actual material benefit, and we're calculating what that is. It'll go to the regulatory commission for, you know, approval. But I also understand that you guys, in its recent filing, has a time of use aspect to it. I keep thinking about, okay, well, what's the next, you know, because we're kind of, you know, I can't say I'm doing it, but, you know, I'm going to be, the board's going to be approving it this year, and it's going to get filed. So it's fresh, kind of out of the box. It's a concept that's been around, when I lived in Lower 48 in the 80s, I allowed the electric company to install this device on my air conditioner, my central air, and I paid a lower rate because they could disconnect me for 2 times a day for 15 minutes max. And it was valuable to them because they weren't having to fill a peak generation. And that's almost 40 years ago. But I just wonder what's coming, after, what tools we have other than time of use is probably what Isaac is talking about.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That what you're thinking of. Well, it sounds like maybe this isn't necessarily a recommendation because it's already being implemented. And where I hear Tony and Isaac talking is, what comes after this as we have additional new technology adoption at the residential level.
Yeah, I think there's something material under this heading of innovative rate design that, to facilitate change, because right now it can be an obstacle. I can't think of one right this minute, but I can think that as these things come, we're going to have to be able to, the commission, I think, is going to need to be in a position where it can deal with those kinds of things on a relatively quick manner.
Well, maybe for what we know right now, maybe it's just calling out that it's coming and that we need to adapt, rate or tariff structures based on, as you start to see it, to allow it to grow naturally.
So that's what I was going to say, is even though we see it coming, that doesn't mean it's going to happen, so if we can give it the push through the task force, I think that would be helpful.
So my question then is, are there changes in the way the RCA should be handling some of these developments, just as we talked about for lunch with regards to?
There was a concept that was brought up, I think, in front of the statute of regulations of looking at different modeling that other states have been going to towards the commission. I haven't followed it within that particular subcommittee, but I know that was one that the subcommittee was looking at. To look at an Iowa model, there's a Virginia model. It's just a way that they were doing it with fewer commissioners, but increasing and putting more on staff and administrative law judges as a way to help streamline the process to speed it up. But I don't know where that is with the task force, but I know that was something that was brought up to a task force, to one of the subcommittees.
So is the issue the speed with which I'm trying to get to the root issue here. And I hear that there's models and so it can be followed. Is that the main hurdle?
I think one of the things is rather than wait for the commission to make a decision, if a decision isn't made by a certain date, it is then approved.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of doing it a little bit differently is some of the modeling to look at. And in some states have gone to that, which relieves the pressure off the commission too. If it's not a controversial thing, if it's not discussed by the state, it's automatically approved. So
is that something that should be recommended?
John, and then I think Carl has his hand up.
Oh, Carl, please.
Oh, Carl, your audio is not coming through.
Sorry, thanks, Jen. Carl Hahnemann, the Statutes and Rates Committee has heard a number of things that... where we've heard a number of things about how the RCA might be able to facilitate more rapid kind of adoption of technology rates and such, but you can get either very specific or you can be general and just say that... we recognize that the RCA perhaps needs more tools in their toolboxes and maybe more resources to be able to respond in the future. So that's certainly being considered. And I think will be recommended. in a broad sense that, we cannot continue to expect that the RCA can respond to more complex and rapidly changing environment without more support and maybe more staff.
Keith, and then I think we're just about at time, so
I'd just like to follow up. Keith Kerber for, from the RCA for the record, is that I think Carl said that spot on. You know, I left active duty in the Army when it had 780,000 soldiers in it, and 5 years later it had 480,000, and the mantra then was you need to learn to do more with less better. And I was in the reserves watching friends of mine literally, like, had many strokes as the promotion rate to major went from 80% on average to, for my year group, 35%. In special forces, it was 39, which meant really, like, 39 actual human beings who could fit into an elementary school classroom got promoted. Why do I bring that analogy up? There comes a point when you get target overload, and there is a lot happening. And I think that, Carl, I just want to sort of pile on to say, you cannot do more with less better. It's just not, it's a nice sound bite, it's nice meme, but it's dumb. So anyway, I just offer that for a little bit of a color as we close lunch out. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Aaron, are you still okay? I know these are kind of rough brushstrokes. Are you okay just taking a first pass? And we can, the golden is for, Mark is first going to just send out the draft action one-pagers, and then for Monday next week, we're just going to go paper by paper, have a group discussion, and capture comments. If we need to, I think if we're getting bogged down in wordsmithing, we should move on and figure out a different way to do those edits. But let's hit the broad stroke concepts to make sure that those are captured within each of the one-pagers. And then at the end of that session, we can talk about how we think those actions should roll up into the broader executive summaries. Tony, anything that you'd like to say before we close?
No, just thanks to you and the task force, all you've done.
Great. All right, great. Well, thanks, everybody. Appreciate everyone working through lunch.